All right, we're back here on Chewing the Yacht with Chris Champagne, a new talk show on WAMF 90.3 FM, New Orleans. And today we have a special guest, an Orleanian who's could be and probably is the foremost Beatle expert on the planet Earth, Bruce Spicer. Thank you.
Well, I'm certainly the most qualified expert in this radio room right now, no doubt about that.
Well, that's anybody I'm in a room with.
That's true.
On any subject.
That's true.
So I got that going for me.
All right.
But you know, don't be modest. You are, in fact, one of the foremost Beatles experts in the world. In fact, how many books on the Beatles have you written?
I've now written 10. I have my 10th one that'll be coming out this November. And this November is the 50th anniversary of the release of what is known as the White Album, the Beatles double album. And, Chris, I remember those 50 years ago like it was a couple of weeks ago. I remember a Friday where I got home from school, and before going out, I was listening to WTIX, and they played a song by the Beatles I hadn't heard before, and the disc jockey said that the Beatles had a new album that'd be coming out soon, and they'd be playing songs from it throughout the weekend. And all weekend long, I kept hearing these really great Beatles songs I'd never heard before, and it was a real exciting weekend for me.
I bet. I mean, well, you know, whenever a Beatles album would come out in those days, it was an event. Certainly, among people of our generation particularly.
Oh, absolutely. I don't know if people today can appreciate what an event it was and the anticipation leading up to it. And WTIX in those days used to have a thing they did called the Top 10 at 10, where they would play the 10 most requested songs of the evening at 10 o'clock at night. And I remember by that Wednesday, for something they had started playing that Friday, all songs in the Top 10 were from the new Beatles album.
Right. Yeah, well, they used to have a lot of, I mean, they had so many songs that were on the charts. I mean, I had a friend of mine who was a musician when we went from the time that he was about 11. And so he was into music, and we would discuss it sometimes. And he would say that he'd never heard a Beatles song he didn't like.
Yeah.
You know? And then I remember Baby, You Can Drive My Car came on the radio one time when his mom was driving us back from like a basketball game at Tulane or something. And,
uh-huh.
And his family was also music, you know, people, and they couldn't see any of the beauty in that particular song. It was somewhat unusual, but they had unusual songs. That's one of the things that I liked about them. They had a different take on music, you know.
Yeah, and that was the thing that I think makes the White Album so popular among people is that it covers so many different genres of music.
Right.
And I remember that whole weekend, you know, I'd hear a song, well, that sounds almost like a country western type Bob Dylan song, and then that sounds like a Chuck Berry song, and you know, all of a sudden you've got a beautiful ballad, and then a really loud, I don't think we really used the term heavy metal back in 1968, but Helter Skelter certainly would fit that definition now. And then there was this weird sound collage that when I bought the album, I learned was called Revolution 9. And it was, I mean, it was just incredible because it was like, you know, all weekend long and that week it was like the song in Glass Onion where John says, here's another clue for you all. That's what you were getting for an entire week. Another clue about what the new album is going to be like.
Well, it was, I think that was my favorite album because it's, first of all, because there's so many songs and it's so eclectic.
Yes.
You know, and
my favorite too, by the way.
Is it really? Oh, well, you must enjoy doing this new book then, especially.
Absolutely. You know, it was fun doing it. And when I did my research, going back to old issues of Rolling Stone and Time and Newsweek and things, it was interesting to see the reviews. And I'd remember it didn't get a good review in Time magazine. And when I reread the review, it still wasn't that nice a review, although they did like the songwriting. But kind of called it a motley assemblage of songs or something. And
yeah.
The Beatles, you know, best abilities and worst tendencies or some famous quote like that. But Rolling Stone praised it, and Rolling Stone was about a year old at the time, and they gave it about a 4-page spread with pictures from a photographer at the time known as Linda Eastman, who would later become Paul's wife.
Right. You know, I can't really think of an example except for one that you just said, but there are a lot of things that in our culture, songs, movies, books, that are like, you know, iconic now or in our culture, that if you look back to the original reviews of like the mainstream press like Time or New York Times, they got panned often, you know. So things sometimes grow over time and accrue value that they didn't necessarily, wasn't seen at the moment of their inception, artistically anyway.
No, I mean, and the goofy thing about it, the New York Times, when Sgt. Pepper came out, Richard Goldstein panned the album. And when the White Album came out, three different people for the New York Times actually wrote pieces on the album, and two of them panned it, but Richard Goldstein gave it a good review. So you never know,
right.
But it's fun historically to see how these things were judged when they came out.
Absolutely.
And one of the things the book does is it goes through, the different reviews in the different magazines and newspapers in the United States and also in the UK. You know, how the London Times... what did William Mann of the London Times think of it? Gave it a pretty good review. So, you get that thing. And I think it got better reviews, I think, in the UK than in the US. But the album did better in the US than it did in the UK, if that makes any sense.
Well, sure it does. Especially if you were from that era, you would realize that there were some songs, Beatles songs, that made it into the top 10 in England that didn't make it here.
Yeah.
And vice versa, because people...
A different taste.
Yeah, different taste, absolutely. I want to talk a lot more about the new book, but let's mention some of the older books that you have too, if you don't
sure.
mind, so people know people can get them too. I mean, we can't say any prices, but you can just say that they're available
through a course. Internet's everywhere, including my own. Can I say my own website?
Yeah, you can give your website.
My website is very easy to remember. It's beatle.net, no S on it. So beatle.net.
And you have 9 books are in print already besides the new one.
I have that, but out of that, actually 5 of the, or let's see, 1, 2, 3, 4 of the books have sold out.
Okay.
And so out of the 4 that have sold out, 3 of them are available in a revised and expanded digital edition now.
Okay. All right, so that's beetle.com.
Net. Beetle.net.
Sorry. Pardon me.
That's quite all right.
Beetle.net. That's pretty simple. Even an idiot like me could remember that if I was in my car. Beetle.net. Because it's like, one of these long things, Well... How did this all happen that you became such enamored of the Beatles?
Yeah, well, I was enamored on the Beatles. Putting it in terms of New Orleans, what is the number one question you ask anyone in New Orleans? Where'd you go to school?
Right.
I went to Newman. I was on the Newman school bus in early 1964, and I heard this song that just kind of sounded really different to me, and it was I Want to Hold Your Hand. And I heard it a couple of more times, on the radio at home, because I had a radio, the word was from my parents that my first two sentences were, Daddy, I want an ice cream cone, and Mommy, I want a radio. I had older sisters. They had a transistor radio. I wanted a radio in my room. And so I got a radio in my room when I was a little kid and loved listening to WTIX. I never listened to WNOE. You grew up in New Orleans. You were one or the other.
That's right.
It was very territorial. So I was one of the boss jocks. I was not a good guy.
Okay. It was either I was going to mention that before. It was either WNOE or WTIX. Yeah,
that was it. But I absolutely loved the music. And the first album that I bought, and I didn't have enough money to buy it myself, so my mom got it for me, was Meet the Beatles.
Okay.
And I had a cousin, Barry, and... his first album was Introducing the Beatles. So between the two of us, we had their first two available U.S. albums.
You had it covered, yeah, absolutely. Well, did you go see him in 64?
Honestly, no.
You were too young?
Well, I was too young to go by myself, and I had older sisters, and one of my sisters, it was her 16th birthday. And unfortunately for me, she was into Barbara Streisand and Peter, Paul, and Mary, and had really no desire to go see the Beatles, and said... You wouldn't hear anything anyway. All my friends tell me all they do is scream at the concerts. And I figured I'd see them the next time they came to New Orleans. And, of course, there was no next time.
Right. Well, Paul McCartney's coming back in the spring.
Yeah, I think I might make it to that.
Okay. It's not the same thing, but at least it's as close as you're going to get at this point. I may have told you this before. I don't want to horn into your time here, but I want to talk to you more than if me say things. But my cousin Mary used to work for Alan Toussaint and Cosmo.
Oh, boy.
So she was there when Paul did the album here.
Mm-hmm.
And as it turns out, her children are basically the same age as Paul's. So one of her gigs at that time was to, take care of the kids. So her kids and his kids got to be really close friends at that time.
Uh-huh.
So usually if he comes back, he used to give her a call just to say hi.
That's very nice. He's like that.
Yeah. So I'm hoping that he's going to do that again for her because she's had a couple of health issues and she's still... But she's still hanging in there and... That was kind of a little Beatles. I wasn't I wasn't close with her then, so I didn't get any of the Beatle...
None of the perks.
None of the perks, but... Now, your new album... What's the name of your new album?
New book. Yes, okay. New book is called The Beatles White Album.
Right.
And The Launch of Apple. So in addition to covering the White Album, it covers how the Beatles' own record company started, which was called Apple. And basically, Paul got the idea from Apple because he had seen this Magritte painting of this big green apple that an art dealer sold to him, and he had that. And also, his idea was, well, what's the first thing that a child learns when they're learning sentences? You know, A is for apple.
Right.
And then also, he said, well, you know, have you ever heard anybody say anything bad about an apple and an apple for the teacher? And so I thought it would be a really good name. And they got this photographer to take a picture of this bright green Granny Smith apple, and that became the logo and on the record label. And so they were going to put out not only their own records, and they were still signed to EMI and Capitol, so although they were technically not Apple recording artists, the record companies accommodated them by having their releases appear on the Apple label on the records themselves. But they signed some artists as well. They signed Mary Hopkin, who Twiggy had seen in a show called Opportunity Knocks and suggested to Paul that she might be someone good to sign to the new label. And Paul had always had this idea for a hit single in the back of his mind, a song that he had heard some folk singers do in London that were from New York but would go to London once a year, and the song was called Those Were the Days. And he thought that would be perfect for Mary Hopkin. Ended up being number one in the UK and number two in the US, so it did quite well for them. They also had a single by Jackie Lomax, a great song called Sour Milk Sea, that did not chart in the U.S. or England, but did make top 30 in Canada. And the other single they did was by a brass band. Did not get any airplay in New Orleans or anywhere, really, called Thing You My Job. And, of course, the big four of the Apple, the big hit, was Hey Jude and Revolution. Okay. So, essentially, they launch a record company, and their first two releases are million sellers. Out of the first four, they released 2 million sellers. Quite a start. And so, you know, Hey Jude and Revolution came out. And, you know, once again, you know, fond memories of that song that summer. Hearing it actually, toward the end of August, last night at camp up in Maine. And we used to be able to get WABC up there. And I hear this song and get back to New Orleans, run over to Studio A by Harrison Avenue. And
Harry Connick Sr.'s record store.
That's correct. And then manager Bill, and I walked over to the album section looking for the new Beatles album, and I didn't see one. I said, do you have a new Beatles album? And he said, no. There's no new Beatles album. And I said, well, I heard this song on the radio a few nights ago that had to be 7 or 8 minutes long. That can't be a single, can it? He said, yeah, they have a new single coming out. Huh. And I thought, wow. You know, and of course the song was. It was 7 minutes and 11 seconds long.
Yeah.
Those
were the days, my friends. I have an anecdote that I have to say.
Absolutely, it's your show.
I was doing some research for a different show that I do, a radio show. I was looking up infamous dictators. So there's this guy. I don't know if he's the head of it anymore. It's Equatorial Guinea. His name is Teodoro Obiang, and at one point, he decided that his cabinet was not being loyal to him.
Mm.
So he fired them all, but he also executed them all on the same day.
Seems reasonable.
And he did it at the soccer stadium
where
people could come and see. And throughout the entire day, they played the song, Those Were the Days, My Friends, and over again.
Oh, my goodness.
The PA system.
That's pretty wild.
That's pretty wild. It is pretty wild.
I don't know what Mary Hopkin or Paul would think about that.
What about BMI? Okay, I wonder if they got ASCAP. I wonder if they got royalties for it. But you know, one thing I wanted to, before I forget, I wanted to ask you if you because you did the Trivial Pursuit,
yes,
Beatles questions, which is a great quiver in your arrow in your quiver there of being a Beatles expert. Can you give us maybe two or three trivia questions at the end? We'll give the answer.
Yeah, one of them that I kind of like is when the Beatles came over, you know, what airplane did they fly on? You know, who was the airline? What type of plane? And even more fun than that, what was the name of the plane? And it has a New Orleans connection, so remember to ask me the question.
All right.
But But the airline in particular used to name their airplanes. So we can do that and see if anybody out there knows the name of the airplane.
Okay.
Kind of a goofy one.
All right. That's one.
That's one. Okay. And, oh.
I'm not putting you on the spot here. I should have told you before we started.
Yeah, you know, you give me a little bit of a warning there, you know. Let's see. Well, we could also, we could do the old weather thing about name some Beatles songs with related to weather.
Okay. Well, I'll tell you what you want to think about. We can go on to something else.
Sure.
Pop up one.
You know, and the reason I brought that one up was, you know, I was at a Beatles convention at like 5:30 in the morning where one of the morning shows is interviewing me, and the weatherman walks up to me and he says, oh, well, name some Beatles songs with the, you know, with the weather in it. You know, and you're standing here at 5:30 in the morning.
Yeah.
No preparation. And fortunately, I was able to pull it off and name them.
Well, so. There you go. See, because you're the expert.
Well, I tell you, boy, the pressure was on.
Oh, no, I understand. I understand that.
Well, the barometer again, pressure was on, too, but that's another story
well,
altogether.
That's his job, not mine. That's right.
That's right. Okay.
Now, you can look up Bruce on beetle.net, see some of his other books, and see some other things about him, I'm sure, on there. Bruce Spizer from New Orleans' own, foremost Beatle expert probably in the world, or at least one of them, anyway. So tell us a little bit about the Trivial Pursuit thing. I mean, they came to you, or?
Yeah, they contacted me. They said they had gone to, essentially, everything has to be licensed by Apple, the Beatles company.
Yeah.
And Apple recommended me. So
okay.
That's how I got the
gig.
Well,
that's pretty cool.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, did you, what did you learn in this, the White Album, the new one, the White Book, whatever, that you're coming out with now? Is there anything that you, things that you learned that you were really surprised about that you didn't know?
Well, you know, I didn't learn all that much on it because I'd covered it in previous books.
Yeah.
What I always found fascinating about it was that before they recorded the album, they got together at George Harrison's bungalow in Esher, England, and recorded a bunch of demos of the songs they would be doing. And it's fascinating. They've been bootlegged for years, but rumor has it they will be included in a White Album special edition coming out, and it's just fun to listen to. It kind of, for those who remember the show MTV Unplugged, it's sort of like the Beatles Unplugged.
Okay.
And it's fascinating. A bunch of the songs were sort of complete, although some they might have two of the three verses and don't have the final verse yet. Some of them slightly rearranged, but it's a, you know, fascinating listen.
What are some of the other titles that you have of some of the other books, that your recent ones that you came out with?
Well, last year I did one on called The Beatles and Sgt. Pepper, A Fan's Perspective. And I spelt fans, F-A-N-S, apostrophe. And I discussed it with the English teachers, and they assured me I was grammatically correct because it was a perspective from the fans, meaning plural, not yeah. just one fan. It was a fun book to do because I had a whole middle section in the book where I asked fans to just, you know, send into my website or email me their Sgt. Pepper stories. And some of them were very touching. You had someone where this guy up in Maine said that their mom had died a few years before the album came out, and they lived with their father in the country, and they would go into town, and they bought the album. Their father didn't particularly like rock and roll, but they played the album before he got home. And one day he came home, and they were playing it, and it happened to be on When I'm 64, and he loved the song.
Oh.
And so whenever he'd come home, he'd ask him, can you play that for me? And it was touching, and the guy said that his father had passed away, and he said he was about to turn 64, and he said, of course, he would, you know, play it in honor of his dad.
Sure. Well, you know, that's...
Really touched me.
I can see that. You can see it emotionally yeah. even talking about it right now. I can see that. And, well, you know, that's the thing that I was going to ask you actually next was... You know, you have people who have purchased your books mm-hmm. from all over the world.
Yes.
And I was going to ask you about feedback that you get from, you know, I mean, what are some of the more unusual places that you, well, not that any place is necessarily unusual in this day and age, we're so connected, but I mean, you know, how many countries do you think you've sold these books to?
A pretty good number, because the Beatles are popular just about everywhere. And when I was doing the Pepper book, because it ties in with the fan recollections thing we were talking about, when I was doing it, the book was literally done. You know, I'm finished, done, no more. My graphic designer is going to send it to the printer the next day. And that Sunday morning, I get an email, you know, Dear Bruce, spelled B-R-U-S-E. And as I start reading it, I realize it's a guy who's writing from Russia. And he tells the story of he was a medical student, and the album was smuggled in, and a friend of his knew someone who had a copy of it. So while he's in medical school, he gets to hear Sgt. Pepper, you know, a few months after we did. But it was just so incredible to hear something. And the way he described it was, you know, here's my story from behind the Iron Curtain.
Right.
And it was just a fabulous thing to get. The fan recollections were fun. One of the best ones I had was Billy Joel had a great little fan mm-hmm. recollection, a really fun one. And I won't spoil it for you. People should go out and buy the book and read Billy Joel's telling about the first time he heard Sgt. Pepper. It is a wonderful story.
Okay, well, that's something to look forward to for sure.
But, you know, other countries, certainly Russia, all over Europe, Australia is very popular, the Philippines, and even, you know, you get some countries in the Middle East, Israel, places like that. So, you know, obviously I haven't hit every country in the world, but a pretty good number of countries.
Well, it's interesting, of course, that in Russia in those days, that they had to smuggle it in.
Absolutely.
I mean, you know, I'm sure that there are some countries right now where you can't get access to information.
Yeah, if we do a show another time, I'll have to tell you a little bit more about the Russian stuff. It's fascinating how they listen to the music. The short story is they listen to them. They would be copied onto film, and what they would use was X-ray film. And most of the X-rays were chest X-rays, and so they would call them ribs.
I see. Okay. You have a trillion interesting stories in this field as far as, you know,
And of course, Chris,
the world.
You know, and one of the things, too, is when people have said, well, you know, what got me to write about the Beatles? I mean, I love the Beatles since I first heard I Want to Hold Your Hand on the Newman School Bus, but why, after all these years, did I write my first book 20 years ago? And what happened was a little bit before that, say 24 whatever years ago, I had settled a big lawsuit and I had some disposable income. And I had noticed, and this could only happen in New Orleans, that roaches had eaten the spines of my album covers or my Beatle albums.
Oh.
They left Meet the Beatles alone, thank goodness. But the other ones, and so I needed to replace those records. And I wanted to replace them with the records that came out in the 60s. I didn't want, you know, 1990s pressings. And so I tried to find out about original records, and when I looked into it, what I was reading in other books didn't make any sense. And I kept asking people about it and said, oh, yeah, it's in every book. And being an attorney, I thought, well, what if every book's wrong?
Yeah.
The early records were on a company called VJ, and they were also on Capitol, and I figured the two companies had to sue each other, and they did. And I found out that there were four lawsuits, one in Chicago, one in L.A., and two in New York. And I got copies of those lawsuits, the complete records, and went through the case records and did a book called The Beatles Records on VJ. And it was going to be a footnote in Beatles history because they only had 16 songs, VJ did. But what was fascinating when I did the book, I realized because of their brilliant marketing strategy, they released 16 different records using those 16 different songs. So they had Introducing the Beatles. And then they reissued Introducing the Beatles called Songs, Pictures, and Stories of the Fabulous Beatles. And when you pulled the record out, it was Introducing the Beatles, but in a new attractive cover.
I see.
Things like that. The Beatles versus the Four Seasons. It was a gatefold album. And when you pulled out the Four Seasons album, it was the Four Seasons Golden Greats. And when you pulled out the Beatles album, it was Introducing the Beatles, because those were the only songs they had.
So it was a battle of the bands.
Yeah, you know, and it was kind of, and they actually had a scorecard on the back of the album, and you could score each song and decide who the winner was.
Well, that's pretty interesting. I know you look back to some of these things, like from when we were kids, or even young adults, and some of it's kind of hokey.
It was.
To us, you know, looking. But still, it's also endearing in a sense to me.
Yeah.
You know.
One of the other early albums that some of your listeners may remember seeing in record stores and maybe even having the misfortune to buy. It was one of an old English man with a monocle on it, and at the top it said, Jolly Watt, the Beatles and Frank Ifield on stage. Well, the weird thing about it was it did have four songs by the Beatles and eight by Frank Ifield, but they weren't on stage. They weren't live at all. And people said, well, why would you put four Beatles songs and eight Frank Ifield? Why not the other way around? When I did my research, it dawned on me what happened was that the four Beatles songs on the album were the only four songs that VJ really had the legal rights to release.
Okay.
They didn't have the rights to put out the Introducing the Beatles album because they put it out too late. They had a right of first refusal. They didn't put it out in time. So it was like a fallback album. So even if we can't put out Introducing the Beatles and we get sued for doing that, we can still have this other album with these four songs. It'll be okay.
It's interesting how, I don't know if that's the right word, but it's how much legality has to get involved in these things.
It does. You know? And, you know, and people, a lot ownership. Of people were telling me, look, you're the perfect person to write these books because you have a legal background, you also have a CPA, and because of all that, you know, you can review the royalty statements, the court cases, and make sense out of it all. And I think between my educational training plus my love of the Beatles, it really did make me the ideal person.
Yeah, I think that's right.
Well,
obviously you've done so many of them now, and they've been successful. So I mean, so I guess that would be a correct assessment.
Yeah, but it was going to be, look, Chris, it was going to be one book. The book comes out, and all of a sudden, you know, people like it, and they're like, well, when's your Capitol book coming out? So the next thing I know, I'm doing a book on the Beatles records on Capitol, and when I get past 500, I realize I need to break that into two books, one on the singles, one on the albums. And then even before those books came out, people were going, I can't wait to get your book on the Apple records. So the next thing you know, people are emailing me and telling me what they want the next book to be. And the one book that many people want me to do that I will never do is a book on the Beatles lawsuits.
Oh, okay.
I may be the perfect person to do it,
right.
But why would I want to do a book that will get Paul, Ringo, Yoko, Olivia, Apple, Capitol, Universal Music Group, and God knows who else angry with me?
Yeah.
Never going to happen.
Well, you seem to have a decent relationship with them at this point. Is that true?
Yeah, I do consulting work for them, yeah.
Yeah, so I mean, so that would be not a good idea.
Not a good idea.
Yeah. You know, just to get back to something you were saying before about the song, you know, When I'm 64.
Mm-hmm.
There's a great element, I think, in the Beatles' music that harkens back to a softer time that when they grew up.
Absolutely.
The traditions of the ballads that they grew up with.
Absolutely. All of them.
Especially Paul.
Paul, but not just, of course, Paul obviously doing show tunes and things on the early Beatle albums, and then Paul did a whole album of standards. But Ringo was the first rock musician to do an album of standards. I mean, you know, Rod Stewart did it, yeah. Linda Ronstadt did it, yeah. Paul did it. Ringo did Sentimental Journey back in 1970,
okay.
The very first one. And Paul assisted with producing one of the tracks on that album. So obviously Paul as well. And John also... you know, had a soft spot for some of those earlier songs as well, although he didn't, you know, it wasn't really his image. He was more of the rebellious rock and roller.
Right.
Even when John wrote a beautiful, lush ballad, Good Night, he didn't sing it. He gave it to Ringo to sing.
WAMF, New Orleans.
You know, I wanted to ask you about Ringo. I mean, do you keep up with you don't hear much about Ringo anymore. What's he up to? Do you know?
He still goes on tour every year or so with what he calls the All-Star Band.
Uh-huh.
And
yeah.
What he does, he takes people that have had hit singles in the 80s and 90s. And he might have someone like Peter Frampton, you know, and people like that. A Sheila E. was with him one time, and, you know, or Colin from Men at Work, you know, he Joe Walsh. I mean, he's had some really interesting people All-Star Band.
Well, I'm sure you can, if you're a musician and Ringo calls, you answer.
So it sounds like a good thing. And Ringo can be pretty funny because he was being interviewed by Larry King, who was talking about assuming that, you know, that Ringo and Paul play together all the time, which they don't. And he was asking him, and Ringo said, well, he said, I might let him in the All-Star Band. I'll give him, as usual, two or three songs.
Yeah, I need a musical guest for my new show. Maybe I should call him, see if he's not busy.
There you go.
See what he's doing.
And the other thing, too, let's get this out the way. If anybody is going to say, Ringo's the luckiest guy in the world and he's not that good a drummer, that is so untrue. Ringo is a great drummer. And the reason you can tell is when you see these Beatle tribute bands and you see that drummer try to do Ringo, most of them cannot pull it off. You know, when you think of Ringo, you think about that steady beat. He never misses a beat and all. But Ringo has a little bit of a jazz swing element in his drumming as well. I've discussed it with Denny Sywell, who was a jazz session drummer before he drummed with Paul and Wings. And Denny said, absolutely, he's got that swing element to it. It's very subtle, but it's an important part of Ringo's drumming.
Well, I mean, I'm not an expert on this at all, but I've read things about the Beatles, and basically, you know, they reiterate what you just said, that, you know, Ringo was actually chosen because he was a good drummer.
Absolutely.
I mean, as opposed to the opposite. I mean, he always, not that he's not lucky. I mean.
And then there's this famous quote that John supposedly said, which, by the way, John did not say, when someone asked him if Ringo was a good drummer, and John said he's not even the best drummer in the group. That is never something John ever said. Paul is not a bad drummer by any means, but, you know, Ringo is a great drummer. End of story.
Okay. Well, I thought that they were going to do the Gene Krupa story, and they were going to have Paul do it, but maybe I'm wrong. But, well, what's your favorite book that you've done, you think?
Boy, you know.
I mean, it's hard to say. I know,
I think the Beatles are coming. would be the one that I always tell people to go out and buy if they're going to buy one of my books. And the reason I love that book is because it tells it's a really convoluted story of how Beatlemania evolved in America. And you have to have certain things go a certain way for Beatlemania to just explode the way it did. And the weird thing about it is that Beatlemania exploded in America because of three people. And the first person was a 16-year-old girl in Silver Spring, Maryland, named Marcia Albert, who was watching the CBS Evening News with Walter Cronkite. And she saw a story on the Beatles. And she wrote to her radio station, WWDC, saying, "I saw this group, the Beatles, on the CBS Evening News. Why can't we have music like this in America?" So I know the listeners are scratching their head. A 16-year-old girl named Marcia Albert, a disc jockey Carol James, and Walter Cronkite? Yes, because what happens is Cronkite broadcasts that story. Capitol had already signed the Beatles, but they weren't going to put the record out till mid-January. He broadcasts it on December 10th. The girl writes this letter, and WWDC's disc jockey Carol James knows someone who was a stewardess, as they were called in the day, they're flight attendants now,
right,
who was from London, and he asked her to bring the Beatles' latest record to him. And so he put it on the air. It happened to be "I Want to Hold Your Hand," and he had her come down to the station and introduce it. And it's like a movie. The switchboard lights up like a Christmas tree. And all of a sudden, people in Washington want to buy a record that's not coming out for several weeks. And the disc jockey sends a dub of it to buddies of his in Chicago, in St. Louis, and the same thing happens. So Capitol Records is forced to release a record early, and it comes out the day after Christmas. You might say, well, so what? What's the big deal? The big deal is, in those days, kids didn't play video games. They listened to the radio. And they were listening to the radio on Christmas holiday, hearing the Beatles in New York. All three stations jump on it. They have Christmas or Hanukkah money, and Mommy and Daddy can take them to the record store. And before you know it, "I Want to Hold Your Hand" is number one in New York, and the rest of the nation follows. Swan Records, who had put out "She Loves You" and it flopped a few months before, re-releases it. It starts getting airplay. VJ, who had put out "Please Please Me" and it had flopped, re-releases that, and it starts getting airplay. And all of a sudden, the Beatles are getting saturation radio airplay in January. When they come on the Ed Sullivan Show in early February, 73 million people tune in to watch the show. His normal viewership, 20 to 30 million, depending on the
wow.
guest. Many people say, "I first heard about the Beatles on the Ed Sullivan Show." Not so. They were getting saturation airplay. Why was the Sullivan Show important? The first time most people got to see the Beatles perform. Jack Parr had a clip on him a month earlier, but it was just one song, and not that many teenagers watched Jack Parr. I guarantee almost every teenager in America was watching Ed Sullivan that night.
Yeah, I can actually remember the second time they were on. I was with a friend, and we were visiting some friends of his family's out in Houma.
Uh-huh.
And the young lady made it a point that everybody had to watch the Beatles that day. You know.
Yeah, and that was the thing that really caused Beatlemania to explode. But if Walter Cronkite doesn't broadcast that story, Marcia Albert doesn't hear it, and the disc jockey doesn't put it out, and the record comes out in mid-January. If it comes out in mid-January, by the time the Beatles are on the Ed Sullivan Show, they're probably no big deal at that point. Maybe the record's top 10 if they're lucky.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it may have caught on some later time, but it wouldn't have caught on like it did for sure.
No, it wouldn't have exploded the way it did.
No, absolutely not. Well, you know, that's interesting because, you know, in those days, there was so few, you know, we only had the three networks, basically.
Yes.
So
New York had eight television stations, and that was the most in the nation.
Yeah, so if you got on something like Ed Sullivan, then you're really going to get exposed to a cross-section of America
can't
really do now.
And the thing was, it was a variety show, and I know this will freak out your younger listeners, the older people will understand, but families would actually gather together on a Sunday night, sit in the room, and watch the same television.
Right, that's true.
And, you know, now everybody has a TV in their own room, or they watch it on their iPad or whatever.
Well, now that you mention, as we sit here, that's probably one of the reasons why our society is so fractured as well, because we just don't have the same cultural things that we used to have in common.
And that was the thing, radio. I mean, you know, you could listen to WTIX, and while you might hear the Beatles, Frank Sinatra, Fats Domino, Tony Bennett, the Rolling Stones, Donovan, Bob Dylan, all within an hour.
Yeah. I mean, I'm not saying it's not good or bad. I mean, it's better to have more choices. I mean, I'm sure. I'm not saying that it was better the other way, but it just was different.
Yes. Right?
In other words, we had more of a shared culture
country
than we do now. I mean, we still do, but it's more diffused. Well, nothing on a Dave Clark 5, huh? Well, no.
I could talk about the Dave Clark Five. They were on the Ed Sullivan Show more than the Beatles.
I saw the Dave Clark Five at City Park.
Yeah.
Yeah, they came one time after. That was much, well, not that much after. It was just a few years after the Beatles, I guess.
And they had a New Orleans connection because they did the Chris Kenner song, I Like It Like That.
Okay, yeah, yeah.
That was one of their biggest hits.
I used to like the Dave Clark Five. I thought they were, you know, I liked
them. Were, but the difference between the Dave Clark Five and the Beatles was the Dave Clark Five never evolved.
Uh-huh.
You listen to their records, and each one sounds similar to the other. They're great, don't get me wrong.
Yeah, yeah.
What I remember most about the Dave Clark Five, they had a video type thing of when they did the song Catch Us If You Can. It was almost like, we're ahead of the Beatles, Catch Us If You Can. Well, the Beatles showed their dominance by evolving.
Yeah.
You know, with Rubber Soul coming out and showing great songwriting, Revolver showing great sound textures, Sgt. Pepper, you know, great album, the White Album, just, you know, just constant. If you listen to their singles one after the other, you see it so different than, say, on Motown, where a group like the Four Tops might do three singles in a row that sounded pretty similar, and then they'd move on to something else when the third one wasn't a hit. Amorphin and the Vandellas, you know, you'd have, Dancing in the Street, Heat Wave, great. Then Live Wire, which is a rewrite of the other two, but not, okay, then we move on to something else. You never had that with the Beatles. Every single sounded different than the one before.
Well, you know, we talked about earlier that they only came to New Orleans at one time to play.
Yeah.
What were their impressions? I know they were only here briefly, and they really didn't get to see anything because it was such a whirlwind. But in general, I mean, what do they have to say about New Orleans? I mean,
they weren't here long enough to see it, and they wanted to spend time in New Orleans. They had this naive view that they'd be able to walk around the city and see New Orleans. They would, you know, they wanted to meet Fats Domino. They did get to do that,
yeah,
so
right.
That was a highlight for them. But other than that, New Orleans, basically, they flew in, you know, in the middle of the night and flew out pretty much after the concert.
Right.
They were going to have a day off in New Orleans, but Charles Finley, who owned, at the time, it was the Kansas City Athletics, wanted them to play in Kansas City as a matter of pride. And, I think the guarantee for the Beatles here was about $25,000. And he offered the Beatles a guarantee of $75,000. They turned it down. Brian turned it down. He offered it $100,000. Brian turned it down. He said $125,000, which meant he would lose money. Brian turned it down. He said $150,000, and Brian said, let me ask the boys. And he walked in the room where the Beatles were sitting around playing cards, and he said, a guy wants to have you play in Kansas City on your day off in New Orleans, and he's willing to pay $150,000. What should I do? And John said, whatever you want, Epi's fine with us. And so they ended up playing Kansas City and lost their day off in New Orleans.
Well, Charles O. Finley, huh?
Yeah.
But Charles was quite a guy. You know, Charles, this is a little bit off the Beatles subject, but then she mentioned him. When free agency first came up in pro sports and baseball, Finley told the owners that they should let everyone be a free agent every year.
Mm-hmm.
That way, what's happening now wouldn't happen, because only a handful of people are free agents every year now.
Yeah.
So there's a bidding war. The other way, everybody would have got what they deserve down the line, and it would have...
It was a remarkable thing. And on the back of the ticket, it's a really fun ticket, because on the back of it, there's a picture of Charles Finley wearing a Beatles wig. And he says, today's Beatle fan is tomorrow's baseball fan.
Oh, yeah, he was a character for sure.
Great marketer.
He took MC Hammer under his wing when he was a little bitty kid and used to let him hang around the Oakland A's. Nothing to do with the Beatles, but anyway. Let's see. Before I forget, how about the answer to the trivia question?
Okay, the Beatles flew over on Pan Am Flight 100. It was a Boeing 707.
Okay.
And it was named Clipper Defiance, which, if you think about it, the Beatles come here and they're defying the odds of a British group making it big in America. When they flew back to England, that exact same plane was Clipper Defiance, but over the word Defiance, Pan Am put a special sign over it, so it read Clipper Beatles when they flew back. Pan Am reused names on their airplanes. They would retire a name when an airplane retired. So when the Boeing 707 Clipper Defiance was retired, Clipper Defiance was renamed to a Boeing 727. And tragically, that Boeing 727 crashed in Kenner.
So if you do
the research on the flight on Kenner, you will see it was called Clipper Defiance.
So it's the same plane that the Beatles flew?
No, the same name of the plane.
Oh, the name.
The Beatles were on a 707 named Clipper Defiance.
I see, I changed the name. Okay,
the one that crashed in Orleans, or in Kenner, was a Boeing 727 named Clipper Defiance.
I got you.
The weatherman questions, Well, you know, off the top of my head, I had to do it. It was tricky, but of course, immediately I thought, well, Good Day Sunshine. Yeah. But then you also had Here Comes the Sun. You also had I'll Follow the Sun. And you also had Rain.
Right.
Arguably, you could say Sun King, although that was more about a king than the sun.
Right. Okay. Well, yeah, that's your answer to, our trivia questions. I was afraid I was going to forget to ask you before we were finished.
Well, I know how absent-minded you are, Chris. That's why I brought it
up.
Yeah,
I am. I just forgot something you just told me within a half a second. So you can't get much more absent-minded than that. Is there a question or more than one question that people never ask you about the Beatles books and the Beatles that you'd like to answer?
Well, I think the fun one I get asked all the time is, you know, have you ever sat down and interviewed Paul or Ringo? And the answer is no. But when I did the book The Beatles Are Coming, I interviewed three of my childhood heroes. And you might say, well, who was that? Walter Cronkite, Mike Wallace, and Edward Newman.
Okay, wow, that's pretty good. Yeah.
Because when I did The Beatles Are Coming, I felt the press was an important part of the story.
Mm-hmm.
And Edward Newman had done a Beatles story that ran on NBC, which was actually the first major news story on the Beatles that ran in actually early November of 63. And Mike Wallace ran a story on the Beatles that nobody remembers Mike Wallace running, including Mike Wallace. He had no memory of running the story. Why? The story ran on the morning of November 22nd, 1963. And when I talked to Mike Wallace about it, his reaction was, Christ almighty, you know what happened that day. And of course, for the listeners who don't recall, that was the day President Kennedy was assassinated.
Right.
So a few hours before President Kennedy is assassinated, his story's run on the Beatles. Chris, if we have time, I can tell you my interview with Walter Cronkite. Do we have time for that?
Yes, we do.
Okay. So anyway, here I am interviewing Walter Cronkite, the most trusted man in America, telephone interview. And in preparation for it, I watch this DVD called Cronkite Remembers. And in it, Walter Cronkite says, it's a little known secret, but Ed Sullivan learned about the Beatles from a broadcast on the CBS Evening News. And I know that that's not true. And I know that Mr. Cronkite is going to be interviewed by people because we're getting near the 40th anniversary. That's why I'm doing my book. And so I call up, and he answers the phone, and he's very nice, and he sounds like Walter Cronkite.
Yeah, yeah.
And he says, you'll have to speak very loudly because the phone service is not very good up here. And then he laughs, and he says, actually, it's my hearing that's not very good. And I said, well, Mr. Cronkite, before we get started, this is a little awkward, but I need to discuss something with you. I watched the show Cronkite Remembers. Yes, yes. And in it, you say that Ed Sullivan learned about the Beatles from a broadcast on the CBS News. Yes, yes, that's correct. I said, Mr. Cronkite, in all due respect, that is not correct.
Yeah.
And rather than click, he says, oh, well, why do you say that? Because he's a newsman and he wants to get to the truth. And I said, well, Mr. Cronkite, I said, I have a copy of Brian Epstein's appointment book, and it shows that he met with Ed Sullivan on November 11th and 12th at the Delmonico Hotel in New York. And he says, yes, yes, that's where Ed lived, and you're sure about that date? And I said, yes. I said, and you broadcast a story on the Beatles, according to CBS Archives, on December 10th, 1963, 1 month later. And he says, well, is it possible that story could have been broadcast earlier? And I said, well, as a matter of fact, Mike Wallace broadcast it on November 22nd. And he says, well, normally we would broadcast the same entertainment pieces on the same day, but obviously I spent the whole broadcast on the Kennedy assassination. So, but could I broadcast it before Mike Wallace did? I said, well, not according to CBS Archives. He says, well, could they be wrong? I said, well, Mr. Cronkite, the problem is this. There's footage of the Beatles performing in Bournemouth, England in that story, and that footage was shot on November 15th. You see the problem? And he says, yes, I do. He says, but I distinctly remember getting off the set and the phone rang almost immediately, and it was Ed. And he said, Walter, what can you tell me about those bugs or whatever they call themselves?
Yeah.
And I said, Mr. Cronkite, I don't doubt for a second that phone call took place exactly the way you remembered. I said, here's what happened. Ed Sullivan books a group, The Beatles, that are unknown in America on November 12th. They're going to appear on his show several months later. And he doesn't probably give it a second thought. And he's watching TV a month later, and you end your broadcast with a five-minute story on the Beatles. He's all excited. He calls you up right away. And Ed was lousy with names. And Mr. Cronkite laughs. He says, oh, yes, he was. He says, he can't even remember the name of the group from anything. And he says, yes, that's exactly what must have happened. Thank you for setting me straight on that.
Well, that was a pretty, that's a great story. Thank you for sharing it with us. Yeah, that must have been kind of a thrill to talk to Walter Cronkite.
It really was. You know, it meant a lot to me.
Seemed like he was a pretty decent guy, too.
He was. And to him, he was the ultimate newsman. It was more important for him to get to the truth than be right.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, I remember watching that. You know, I remember when he first took off, my recollection might not be truthful. I mean, my recollection of what happened to me is, but as far as the other things, in other words, when I used to watch the evening news every day when I come back from school, and my recollection was that, at least in my house, we used to watch NBC news until Cronkite came.
Yeah, right. And then we were CBS.
And then when Cronkite came on, I started looking at that and sticks. I liked the way that they did it better.
Yeah.
You know, and then he became, you know, over time, you know, such a huge figure in the in our culture, really.
Absolutely.
And so I remember, you know, they would give that list of all the people that were going to be on the show and where they were.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and that was kind of
a
good device, I think.
Yeah, and Walter Cronkite, and he was also gracious enough to write the foreword to the book, The Beatles Are Coming.
Oh, wow. Well, that's pretty interesting.
And I had no idea what a coup that was. I mean, I knew I was excited about it.
Sure.
But afterwards, when the book came out, I was at a Beatles convention, and a guy who was in the book publishing business comes up to me. He's looking through the book, very impressed with it. He says, how much did you pay Walter Cronkite to do the foreword? And I said, what do you mean? He says, how much did you pay him? I said, pay him? He says, well, how did you get him? You know, he couldn't comprehend it because people that famous normally are paid a couple of $1,000 to write a foreword for a book.
Yeah.
But he had graciously agreed to do so. You know, we hit it off well. I regret I never got to meet him in person. He was going to be in New Orleans as a keynote speaker at what was then the D-Day Museum. And the event was scheduled for 2 months after Hurricane Katrina. And, of course, it was canceled, and he didn't come to New Orleans. So I did not get to meet him, although I did get to go in his office. He was in New England at the time and got to actually, well, I walked up to something and I asked his chief of staff, Marilyn, I said, is that what I think it is? She's like, yeah, you can touch it. It was a moon rock.
Oh, wow. Yeah, wow. You didn't catch anything?
Didn't catch anything.
Okay. Well, that's good. No Andromeda strain or anything?
No Andromeda strain. Okay. Although it did make me like the Beatles, but then I liked the Beatles before I touched the moon rock.
Have you ever gotten any feedback from the Beatles?
I have heard a story, not directly, but when I was in Las Vegas at a time when both Ringo and Paul were there for the premiere of The Love Show, one of the people that I got to meet there was Ringo's videographer. He was with a group of people we were hanging out. And I asked him, if I give you a copy of one of my books, will you give it to Ringo? And he said, I'll be happy to do that, but I have to warn you. Normally when I give something like that to Ringo, Ringo goes, eh. And I end up with it. So he says, if you don't mind the fact I might end up with your book, I said, that's fine. And the book was one of my books called The Beatles Solo on Apple Records. And it had, of course, just what it sounds like, a section on John's solo records on Apple, Paul's, George's, and Ringo's. So he gives it to Ringo, and he calls me up about 2 days later, and he says, bad news about the book. I said, oh? He says, I didn't get to keep it. He says, Ringo took it. He says, but not only did Ringo take it, he says, but Ringo's flipping through the book, and Paul drops by to tell Ringo goodbye because Ringo's staying in Vegas to do a concert. And he says, Paul walks in and sees the book, and Ringo points to him, and he says, that's my record on the cover, not yours, because on the cover it had it Don't Come Easy.
Uh-huh.
And Paul starts flipping through the book and then, you know, leaves. And then he said Ringo took it with him when he went to the concert, reading it in the limousine. So,
well, that's pretty cool.
It was nice to see it.
Yeah, it was nice something I chucked to call and tell you that, too.
Yeah, it really was.
It was, yeah. Well, that's a good story to maybe end. I think we were running out of time, unfortunately. In fact, you know, we got a little more. But
all right.
One of the things I wanted to ask you was about the solo careers.
Uh-huh.
If you had done anything, and obviously you've done a book.
Book on the Apple stuff, and... The other person that I got to meet through the Beatles world was Sir George Martin, who died, unfortunately, recently.
Yeah.
And I was at the Love Show in Vegas, and they had like a preview. This was about 2 months before the show opened for the press. And they did about a 5-song sequence. And for those who haven't heard the Love album, it's kind of like almost mashups of Beatles songs. Very creative, very different. And afterwards, Sir George, after he's being interviewed by a bunch of people, I was talking to his wife, Judy, simply because I figured he's going to come back to Judy eventually. And when he did, I started to introduce myself, Sir George, my name is Bruce Spicer. I've written a couple of these. I know who you are, Bruce. And I said, oh, my God, George Martin knows who I am. And he said, I know you're a real purist about the music. Are we going to get brickbats thrown at us for this? Because he was insecure about messing with the music. And I said, no, you won't. I said, a few people won't get it. Don't worry about them. I said, it's dynamic. It's exciting. It's creative. It's so well done that people are going to really love it. You don't need to worry.
Well, you know, George Martin gets credit, but probably not as much as he deserves, I think.
Yeah, no, he, you know, people, who was the fifth Beatle, if you ask, George Martin.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
He was in the studio with him.
Well, Bruce, we've been talking to Bruce Spicer today on WAMF FM 90.3 New Orleans. And I want to thank you for taking the time out of your busy schedule to be with you. You're a good friend, and I'm really glad to spend this time with you and listen to your interesting stories. I think that I could probably think of about 20 other questions to ask you, so maybe we can do this again sometime.
Well, absolutely. Next time what you can do is write down a list of questions so you don't forget them, since you told me how bad your memory is these days.
That's true, yeah, yeah.
Do you remember telling me that earlier in the show?
No, I don't remember that.
That
no,
you
no,
see?
No, it's getting bad. I eat too much canned goods or something. I'm not sure what it is.
I give too many canned answers, so it works out well.
Oh, there you go. There you go. Perfect.
All right.
We talked to Bruce Spicer, Beatles.
Beatle.net.
No
Beatle.
S. No S.
BEATLE.NET.
Beatle.net.
Beatle.net. All
right. Beatle.net.
Okay.
All right. Thanks, man.
Glad to do it, Chris.
Appreciate it. Listen to WAMF FM New Orleans 90.3 on your radio dial.
Say you want a revolution. Well, you know, we all want to change the world. Tell me that it's evolution. Well, you know, we all want to change the world. But when you talk about destruction, don't you know that you can count me out? Don't you know it's gonna be all right? All right, all right. You say you got a real solution. Well, you know, we'd all love to see the plan. You ask me for a contribution. Well, you know, we all do what we can. But if you want money for people with minds that hate, all I can tell you is, brother, you have to wait. All right. All right. All right. Constitution. Well, you know, we all want to change your head. You tell me it's the institution. Well, you know, you better free your mind instead. But if you go carrying pictures of Chairman Mao, you ain't gonna make it with anyone anyhow. Don't you know it's gonna be all right? All right.